person was elected as king, or he was elected as president of the United States. Could you not still see this exact same comment made? But we would have, you know, air quotes, a godly, God-fearing leader. But what about the people? What would happen in conversations like homosexuality? Would the people be turned from their idol? Would the people be turned from their beliefs? Would it be the popular thing to be religious? No. Changing that leadership wouldn't magically make this happen. Pick any number of topics that are going on out there that's going on in our society, in our day, in our time. If we was to magically put a really godly person, a true Christian, in the White House, would it help? It would be great. But would it turn the people? Not immediately. Maybe in time. Maybe in time you'd see the country come a little bit closer. And there are some things that some of the kings did. They would go in and they would wipe out the high places. They would just destroy some of the idol worship. And that did make great strides in bringing the people back. But Jotham didn't do that. He didn't go through and just wipe out this idolatrous worship that's going on. So you do have a faithful king, but at the same time, you still have this idolatrous practice that's going on amongst the people. And it's not changing the hearts and the minds of the people. But from the outside looking in, he was an extremely successful king. He defeated the Amorites. Amorites have been a thorn in their side for some time at this point. 2 Chronicles chapter 27. They're paying him now 100 talents of silver, 10 core of wheat, 10 core of barley. Core is a huge barrel, so to speak. Huge barrel of grains, both of barley and of wheat. So these are the taxes that he's taking in from these people. Very successful. He rebuilds the wall. He builds the upper gate of the house of the Lord. So he's making repairs to Jerusalem, to the upper house, to the upper gate, building it back up. He builds the walls of Ophel. He builds cities in the mountains of Judah. He's building fortresses and he's building towers. So from a political point of view, Jotham is doing a really good job. He is a good king. He's godly. He's doing all of these things somewhat to bring the people back. And God does not leave the point out. Why was this true? Why was he mighty? Because what in 2 Chronicles 27:6? He prepared his way before the Lord. Right? He was successful. And if you go back and you look at David, you look at all of the successful kings through time, you're going to see some statement like this. When that success was happening, they prepared their way before the Lord. Typically meaning that they would seek out the law when they were making a decision. What were some of the things kings were supposed to do? Were they not supposed to write a copy of the law for themselves? Was that not one of the commands that was given back when the first king was put on the throne? Write a copy of the law for yourself. Here we have Jotham seeking out the Lord. But at the same time, toward the end of his reign, once again, Jotham is seeking out the Lord, but what about the people? The people are still wicked. The people are still worshiping in the high places. And by the end of this, not against Samaria, not against Israel, but even by the end of Jotham's reign, we see the Lord sent Rezin and Pekah against Judah, right? We don't know now when God's in control and when he's not, right? We can't put our finger on it and say, this is something that God's doing or something God's not doing through his providence. But so many times through the Old Testament, we get the luxury of seeing. God is saying, wake up. God is beginning to send forces in. He's using Rezin of Syria, and he's using Pekah, the king of Israel, and he's coming in and he's pestering. He's coming in, he's attacking Judah and kind of pestering them. At this point, kind of pestering them. Should serve as what to them? A wake-up call. You know, this should serve as a wake-up call to the people. And we could think about things today that should serve as a wake-up call to us. Now, some of the prophets that we're talking about here in this time, we've got Obadiah that was in Judah. We got Joel that was in Judah, both in earlier kingdoms. Then we had Jonah, Amos, and Hosea, but all in the days of Uzziah. Well, Jonah was earlier than that. Amos and Jonah was also the days of Uzziah. So really here, when we were talking about earlier, that this is contemporary. These are all contemporaries. Yes, they may be 20 years apart, but they're very close in time. And he's very much in time with that of Isaiah. Isaiah predominantly talking to the courts. He's talking, trying to get the leaders to repent. Micah spends a lot of his time with the common people. He's talking to the common people and trying to get the common people to understand what's going on, why things are happening, and maybe even understand when we get into chapters 2, 3, and 4, their oppression that they're having at this point. So, can we do a whole book? Just like Jeff and Gary couldn't do justice to Isaiah in two classes, I got a little better shot at doing justice to Micah in one, but still not a lot. There is several classes worth of material that we could have, but we are going to do it in one class. If we want to carry this away in a nugget, right, just the nuggets to take away, the first three chapters is the judgment on both Samaria and Jerusalem, the judgment on Israel and Judah. Chapters 4 and 5, there's a little bit in chapters 2 about this as well. The end of chapter 2 talks about it, but predominantly chapter 4 and 5 is this future kingdom, this future exaltation that's coming from God. That's a messianic portion of this text. Chapters 4 and 5 is very messianic in its tone, in its tenor. And in chapters 6 and 7, we've got God going to court with Judah. I've got a case. I've got a lawsuit against you. And he's going to put his case on the table and let them be heard and let them give their rebuttal. So, judgment, the messianic kingdom, I'm going to judge you, but there is hope. There is hope coming. There is something coming out here in the future, even though I'm about to judge you now. And he ends it with, this is what I have against you. He has this lawsuit that he's going to place before the people, and he ends it with the way of salvation. So let's jump into the first section, the first three chapters, on the judgment that God's about to bring. Now, I like to use this to illustrate this first section, because I have to say this is the first thing my childhood come back to mind when I first read these first few verses. For behold, the Lord is coming out of his place, and he will come down to earth and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him. The valleys will split like wax before the fire, like the waters poured out down a steep place. And I don't know, for me, maybe this isn't right, but for me, this just had the tone of me and my brother in a back room, arguing and fighting. My parents had given the first warning, the second warning, and then comes out of my mother or my father's mouth, do I need to come in there? The picture that we see here is, God is going to, first, he's going to stand up. God on his throne in heaven. First thing he's going to do because of the evil that's going on in the world, he's going to stand up. And next, he's going to come down there. Do I need to come down there? The answer is a resounding yes. God needs to come down there. Why? Because what Israel is doing. So I may be a little bit off, but that is the tone that I have in mind. Hopefully it helps us paint the picture of what's going on. Judah is those children that are in there squabbling and fighting, disobeying their parents. And God says, I'm going to get up and I'm going to come down there. And I never liked it when my mom got up and come into the room, especially if I pulled her away from doing something she wanted to be doing. And it was never pleasant. And it's not going to be pleasant for Judah. When God gets up out of his place and comes down to earth, you look at this language, the mountains will melt under him, the valleys will split like wax before the fire, like water poured out down a steep place. Does that not sound like utter destruction? Right? Who can stand before the Lord? The Lord is getting up. And he's coming down. One might ask the question, why? And God did not leave them with any doubt, with any debate in their mind. Chapter 1 and verse 5, all of this is for the transgressions of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Judah. Now, he gets into this time where he'll start talking about Samaria and Jerusalem. Samaria really means what? It's the capital of Israel. Is the capital of Israel. So when you read Micah and you're reading and he's talking about Samaria, he's talking about Israel. Samaria being the capital of it. And when he starts talking about Jerusalem, in the same sense, when he's talking about Jerusalem, he's talking about Judah as a whole. It's the capital. What he's going to do when he gets to the capital too. And we're going to see what is going to become of Samaria. Verse 6. A heap of ruins. You've seen the archaeological stories and the archaeological studies where you see a city that's just been brought to just rubble. Stone upon stone, rock upon rock. If we want to bring it to something current, you think of those pictures. I saw a picture yet today. I think it was some documentary went by that showed a flashback to 9/11 and just the way that place was destroyed and the way these huge, huge, huge buildings were just a mangled mess. That's the picture that's being painted here. Samaria is going to be nothing but a heap of ruins. This thriving city. If I was to go to St. Louis, Missouri, or if I was to go to Los Angeles, see the hustle and bustle in this thriving city, and say, the place is going to be a heap of ruins. It's going to be, its carved images are going to be beaten into pieces. It's going to be shattered. All of that you see here before you right now is going to be shattered. It's going to be gone. That's the same shock factor that this should have had to the people about the great city, Samaria, or the great city, Jerusalem, here in just a minute. And Micah gets it. Do you think Micah enjoyed giving this message from God to the people? He's with them, right? He's here. He's among them. He's with them. And he has got to give them the message. God is going to come down here and he is going to destroy us. He's going to destroy our cities. We're going to be taken captive. Why? Because of the transgressions of the house of Jacob. That's the message he's trying to get to the common people. This is going to happen, and when you're asking the question, why is this happening to us? It's because of the transgression of the people. Then you go into chapter 1, 8, 9, and into chapter 2, you see this situation where Micah begins to mourn for Israel and for Judah. If you don't mind, get there. I'll read it since I've got the mic on. But when you come down to verse 8, therefore I will wail and howl, and I'll go stripped and naked, and I will make a wailing like the jackals and a mourning like the ostrich, for her wounds are incurable. If I was to put that today in a modern disease, if the wounds are incurable, what is it? It's fatal. There's no hope. When we start talking about Judah here, the wounds here are incurable. There is no hope to come, for it has come. Israel is gone, and it has come as it is to the gates of my people, to Jerusalem. So Israel's about to be destroyed, and it's coming here. It's coming to Jerusalem, the one who actually probably can still consider themselves even religiously superior to those that had. If you think about it from a religious point of view, I would think the people in Jerusalem would be looking down on the people in Samaria. They've already left, right? Ahab and all of the horrible things that's been going on up there. You still see the sense of self-righteousness that's going on. And he ends this with, in this next, the next verse 10 and down, this play on words. It's kind of an interesting play on words. Tell it not in Gath. That doesn't sound too impressive, but if I was to say tell it not in Telltown, right? Gath meaning tell. Tell it not in Telltown. Don't gossip in Gossip Town. Don't tell it in Telltown. Weep not in Echo or weep not in Weep Town. Don't roll in the dust in Dust Town or Beth Orem, right? He's mourning, he's sad, but the message here is don't proclaim to the world what God is doing. Don't draw attention to this. But again, do they have any reason? To really, this is something they brought on themselves. Tell it not in Telltown. Weep not in Weep Town. Roll not in the dust in Dust Town. So following this play on words, he comes to this serious point. And if we was to bring some kind of judgment against us and against our people, what would be the first thing that we would worry about? We would worry about our children. Mourn for your children, for they will go into captivity. Think about those words. Make those words ring true to us. Worry about your children because they will go into captivity to pick a country. Pick a country that hates us right now. These would be words that would sting to the ears of the people. This sounds so harsh. And then he opens chapter 2 and he starts making his case as to why this is true. As you look in chapter 2, go ahead and get your Bible out. Look in chapter 2, the first couple of verses. What's the picture there in verses 1 and 2? You've got a man who's laying in bed at night doing what? Dreaming up all the evil and horrible things that he can do. And what does he wake up the next morning to do, Mike? To go and do it. So he spends his night laying in the bed thinking of what horrible things I can do to the people, what deceptive things I can do to go take what they have that I want. Ooh, that was a good idea. And he gets up the next morning and he goes out and does it. Pretty wicked people. This is the same kind of person in verse 2 that says he sees a field that he wants. Sounds kind of like Ahab and Jezebel, right? Sees a field that he wants, and what does he do? Ahab says, Why are you mourning? Why are you laying down around here? Aren't you the king? Go and take it. This is a group of people that they saw a field that they wanted. And if they were more powerful than the poor man that owned the field, well, they would just take the field. That's the condition that's going on. And in chapter 2 and verse 3, this is words that I would hope would make hair stand on the back of our heads. And hopefully it made hair stand on the back of their heads, but we don't see the sign of repentance. Behold, I am devising a disaster from which you cannot remove your neck. There is a disaster coming. Such a great disaster that's coming, and you will not be able to remove your neck. You will not be able to get away from it. You won't be able to get out from under it. Typically, when somebody has their foot on the neck of an opposing king, what is that? Total defeat. Yeah. You are in complete submission. There, you have no hope. You're not getting out. A lot of times it comes right before death, the foot on the neck. I am bringing a devastating disaster upon you from which you will not be able to remove your neck. And we see, again, this picture continues. If these things are getting so bad, surely the people are beginning to hear and beginning to turn their attitude. But what's their attitude toward? The prophets. Stop prattering. What does pratter mean? Tell the prophets to stop prattering. I had to look that one up. I have to be honest. I had no idea when I read it. Stop speaking. Stop chattering. Stop speaking. Stop prophesying. You go tell these righteous prophets. Stop it. Don't talk to me anymore about what? About this disaster that's going to come that I can't remove my neck from. Tell those prophets. That's what the people are doing. Now, what have we created? We've created a group of prophets that now, if they want to be fed, if they want to be employed, if they want to live peaceably, what had they better do? If they're to stop prattling when they're saying something about judgment, what had they better do? Well, yep, we better be talking about peace. We better be talking about love our neighbors as ourselves, and we better preach only the positive things and never the negative things. Maybe that is. Exactly. Do you see the connection I'm trying to make there between what we do see going on in our world today? If you want to stay employed, if you want to stay out of trouble, you better not preach against these things. You better not talk about judgment. You better not talk about some punishment, some disaster that may be coming. Prophets got to the point they would proclaim peace to anyone who would give them food. They would proclaim war against anyone who would go against them. We've seen the visions of some of the silliness that the fake prophets would do in Israel before the king. They would get their head garments on and they would run. And this is what you're going to do to your enemy and butt them out of the way, right? Well, this is what's going on in Judah now. If it's going to get me fed, and if it's going to keep me employed, and if it's going to make people like me, if you give me a little bit of money, you're going to get the outcome. No wonder Israel or Judah has turned in spiritually into the situation that they're in when this is the kind of leadership, the kind of religious leadership that they have. We still got a good king. We're going to talk about their leaders in just a minute, though. Their leaders aren't much better. But what is the picture here that's being painted of their religious leadership? When your religious leadership turns to nothing but, say whatever you want me to say for a bite of food, for a bit of money, I'll tell you what everything you're doing is okay, everything's going to be right. Once the religious leadership has turned there, you're headed down a horrible road. And Judah is definitely headed down a horrible road. And I echo the comment that was made in chapter 2 and verse 3, that this destruction is coming. They will not be able to get away from it. But they have a good king, so the leadership is good now, right? Chapter 3, the leadership isn't being painted as such a great group of people either. How horrible is it when the rulers abhor justice and pervert equality? Why might a ruler abhor justice and pervert equality? A little louder. Selfish gain. It happened, once you put politics, they were not that much different than we are today. Once you put politics in the matter, we see it all the time now that justice is thwarted for selfish gain, to raise one up into power, to raise oneself up into importance. Equality destroyed. If you've got enough money, verse 9, talks about them hating justice. Verse 11, if you've got enough money, you can get whatever judgment. You come to trial, and a poor man that's been abused is coming to trial against a rich man. Who's going to win that case? The rich man, because he has the money to pay the bribe. Right? Things are getting turned upside down. And that's the picture that's going on in Judah. And that's the picture that Micah is trying to get Judah to see. Everything has been turned upside down. Chapter 3, verse 11, it's repetition. But again, maybe repetition isn't so hard to hear that they'll teach whatever they want. But all along, what are they claiming? When you read that phrase, is not the Lord among us? No harm can come to us. What is the religious leaders trying to say to the people when they say that? What does that mean? That's right. We're the religious ones. We're the Jews. Everything's going to be fine. God's among us. Right? We're the righteous. God's among us. No harm's going to come to us. Is that kind of thinking from the religious leader helping or hurting the situation? It's destroying the people. And again, I'm not trying to necessarily harp, but you see this cycle. This cycle continues as much today as this cycle was going on then. There is a large group around us that believe and would teach, hey, look, as long as you're sincere, as long, you know, you're in the religious group, you're righteous, you're fine, don't worry, God is among us. But Micah had a different story. All through all of this, Micah's message is still the same. Behold, I am bringing a devastating disaster amongst you that you cannot remove your neck from. Now, this is kind of depressing at this point, right? And I'll even say, this has been, if you think about the message that Micah is trying to get these people to understand and to hear, he wants them to take it seriously. But wow, talk about gloom and doom. Even worse than gloom and doom, this is straight from God. So his promises cannot fail. For those who would actually hear Micah, they know that God's promises would not fail. So every word that's come out of Micah's mouth is true, is from God, is going to happen just like he said. You can kind of see why he was mourning, but what would be the general feeling? This is a pretty morbid feeling at this point. And I also find it very amazing that God doesn't leave it at this morbid feeling going on out there. The next thing he does is he turns his attention to the future, this future exaltation of God's people. And he has some very important things to say. Chapter 4, we're in chapter 4 and chapter 5 at this point. The Lord's house will be established on top of the mountain, and all people will flow into it. How many streams have you seen flow up the mountain? Think about the language that's being used here. How many times? Raise your hand. Have you seen a stream flow uphill? Typically don't happen. So here we have this kingdom that's going to come. It's going to be established, or the Lord's house here described. Messianic language is going to be established on top of this mountain. And first, all people, they really don't get this, but we know this means both Jew and Gentile, like all people, all nations, all people will be blessed. He's been saying it since the promises to Abraham. In your seed, all families of the earth shall be blessed. This is just a continuation of those same promises that God's been making. He's making it here yet again, that all nations are going to be blessed. But here you have this thing that's on top of the mountain and all nations are going to flow into it. So you see almost like ants up an anthill, you see all nations flowing up to the mountain with this that's going to happen, with this kingdom, with this Lord's house that's going to be built. And now, does this next phrase from chapter 4 ring a bell with anybody and sound like anything from another prophet? And the people will go up and be taught his ways so they can walk in his path? That's what I'm thinking of, but go ahead. Isaiah what? Do you remember? Or at least a short quote of it? I was thinking of Jeremiah chapter 31, 31 through 34. No longer will they be taught, know the Lord, they will know me. Again, both of these, this language of this kingdom, this house that is to come, that's going to be established, that is to come, you're not going to, you know, they'll go up to be taught his ways. They will know the Lord. They will walk in his paths. Again, they're not, this is not the language they're going to be righteous just because they're Jews, just because they're Abraham's seed. They will be taught his ways and they'll walk in his path. You see this kind of transition. And from all this destruction, from this language, all this destruction that's going on, when you read passages that said they'll beat their swords into plowshares and they will beat their spears into pruning hooks, what do you get from that? What's the picture that's being painted with these words? That's right. These weapons, you can now go home and take all of your guns, melt them down for the iron, and reshape them into a tool that you use in your everyday life, because you're not going to need your guns anymore. That's what's being said here. Take that sword, take that spear, and you can go and reshape it, because you're not going to need a sword anymore. You're not going to need a spear anymore. So we've gone from this horrible destruction. Could you imagine living in that kind of utopia? Wait, maybe we should imagine living in that kind of utopia, because in and amongst the church, that is the utopia that's being described, where there's no need for the sword, there's no need for the spear that can be put into a pruning hook. But for now, you must go into Babylonian captivity, chapter 4 and verse 10. So we've gone, hey, there's this bright light here at the end of the tunnel. It's coming. Deliverance is coming. But for now, you must go into Babylonian captivity. Does anybody think of anything interesting about this fact, that you're going into Babylonian captivity? Assyria is the one in command right now. So shouldn't, you know, if I'm a prophet and I'm speaking and I want some street cred for what I'm saying being true, I'm trying to think of a comparison. Somebody tell me a small little country right now of fairly small insignificance. I'm blank. I'll go with Turkey because it's the only thing that come to mind. Okay. Turkey is going to come in and be the next world power and take everybody over. Babylon. At this point, we think of Babylon as this great nation that does in time come in and takes Judah captive and pretty much owns control over the whole known world at that time, down to Egypt and up into Asia, up to the Euphrates, up in this area. They're in control. But at the time that Micah says this, Babylon is Turkey. I mean, Babylon is this small little country over here, has no power. They're under Assyrian control. They're under dominance. I can imagine when it come out, we're going to go into captivity to them. Really? Them? But as it turns out, give them a few years, Assyria comes, Assyria rises, Assyria falls. Babylon is the next major. And without really knowing it, God has given them some sense of a time factor of what's going on here. And then, kind of in that same fashion, so here's Micah, the smallest country over here, is going to be the one that's going to rise and be the greatest in power. Now he makes the statement, though Bethlehem is little among Judah, out of you will come the ruler of Israel, who's going forth or from old, from everlasting. So now that we've gone from the tiniest little country is going to come over and be our ruler, now the tiniest little group, Benjamites were known, Bethlehem, this area, they've been known for a few things, but really? Powerhouse? You know, they said of Jesus, does anything good come? You know, Bethlehem? Really? Out of Bethlehem, Ephrathah? A ruler of Israel is going to come. Again, you have these things. And I'm trying to put us in the mindset of trying to understand how strange these things must have sounded to the people that was hearing it. But to those who believed, to those who had faith, they knew God's word was true. So they knew it was going to happen. They may not have understood how it was going to happen, but they knew it was going to happen. And speaking of this ruler, won't go into this a lot because this is almost, and I don't know how much time Gary and Jeff had to really dive into this area of Isaiah, but Isaiah does a really good job of just painting this beautiful picture of what this Messiah is going to be, what this ruler is going to be. Micah, much more condensed, this ruler is going to come from a lowly birth. And you can talk about, we've already talked about Bethlehem, much more that's said in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 about this lowly birth that he's going to be coming from. He shall restore the remnant from among many people. They're going to think of the remnant as from who? From Judah, right? But this is a remnant that's from many peoples. Again, another reference, though they don't get it. And if I was there, I wouldn't get it either. I'm not pointing any fingers at them because I really think of how hard it would have been to understand God's messages without the luxury of hindsight. I mean, think about understanding the things that he said, even to his apostles, without the luxury of hindsight. It's really tough sometimes. He shall stand and feed his flocks. All of his enemies will be defeated. No one can stand before him. Wickedness and idolatry will be cut off. Again, to a group of people, this is a beautiful picture of utopia. This is the perfect kingdom. This is the ruler I want. This is the kingdom I want to live in. He's going to stand. He's going to feed his flock. None of our enemies are going to come in and harm us. Do they understand what he's truly trying to picture? No. And sometimes I have to ask the question, we know he's painting a picture of what? The kingdom that we're now a part of. Do we get this, right? Do we view this kingdom that we're a part of the way that the prophets of old visualized? I know I fell in that area. It's one of the reasons I pointed out. So now he said, judgment is coming. But there's this beautiful light at the end of the tunnel because something beyond this judgment is coming and it's going to be great. Right? This great land of peace is coming. Chapters 4 and 5. But now we're going to come back and deal with this question. Israel? Judah? Arise, God says to them, arise and plead your case. The court is now in session. I have a complaint against you. Testify against me. What have I done to you? Think about that for a second. Isn't that kind of a stop in your tracks kind of moment? Because what are, as people started thinking about and as these punishments started unfolding, what do you think is the first thing that's coming to these people's minds? Why is God doing this to me? Why is God, we're the righteous ones, we're God's people, why is God doing this to me? It's the natural thing that's going to come to their mind. Because again, why? They see themselves as righteous. Testify against me. What have I done to you? What have I done that you hold against me? Well, let's see. I brought you up out of Egypt and redeemed you from bondage. I sent you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam before you. By the way, what was it that Moses had given them? The law to know how to be what? Pleasing to him. I defeated the council of Balaam and Barak. I have protected you. I've taken you and I've protected you. What was the people's response? How can I please you? With what can I do to please you? It's become nothing more. What shall I come? Will I come with 1,000 burnt offerings? Well, shall I come with 1,000 rams? 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my sins? You see the disconnect between what God says and where the people are at right now? God replies in chapter 6, in verse 8. And we're going to end with this, so if you don't mind, turn there. Micah chapter 6, verse 8. With all this buildup, I sure hope I don't have the wrong text on the screen. And he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Does this not sound a lot like what shall I do in, you know, when Jesus is talking to them, what shall I do? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. What does he want from us? What does he want from us from the beginning of time? I think this verse 8 sums it up. To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. Sorry, we kind of did the lessons as we went through versus saving them at the end, but they just kind of fit as illustrations for the class. Thank you for your time and attention tonight. And I think everybody's back Sunday morning.